So what I wanted to do tonight is actually read from the book that I'm working on now, which is nearing completion. It needs a lot of work still, but it's called Wonders of the Invisible World. And if you're unfamiliar with my writing, it's generally realistic, but it always has intrusions of the fantastic into it, and they're largely used as metaphors. In the case of this book, it's about three generations of a family in northeastern Ohio, and is told by the youngest child in the most recent generation. And in the case of this book, the sort of fantastical element in it is that there's a kind of gift or curse, depending on how you look at it, that sort of follows in the line of his family for a kind of second sight. But in his case, it showed up differently. It's not that he can see the future. It's that he's able to see the past. So the invisible world in this book is really the past, and also stands in as a kind of metaphor for Rust Belt communities that have been sort of suffering a loss of identity as communities for some time now. So this chapter is from early in the book, when he's started to see things, basically visions, for the first time in his life, and he's not able to make sense of what these things are. And the only other thing that I will say before I start reading is that there's one other kind of fantastical thing in it, is that the men in his family, there's a sort of curse that they see this sort of mythological creature, the white stag, and it sort of compels them to chase after it. So that makes an appearance in here, and I don't want it to come as a surprise. But the chapter is called Snow Angels. That winter, between the times he was called out by the roads department to plow snow off and the times he went out into Marrow's Ravine to hunt during deer season, my father was absent so often that not having him around the house felt more natural than when he was home. Snow started falling in mid-December, keeping him from us, and continued falling, it seemed, every day after that first one. This was excellent news for me and my brothers. The more snow we had, the more school was canceled. Our first snow day, all three of us, even Wren, who was trying hard that year to appear more mature than me and Toby, anxiously prepared to go out into the drifts that had piled up during the night while we were sleeping. Our mother didn't mind our going out to have fun, but she insisted we gear up as if we were going to war. I don't want to see any of you coming down with something later on because you didn't wear your gloves this morning. So we pulled on our boots and gloves, our stocking caps and winter jackets, preparing to face the winter cold. I was in such a hurry to get outside that I was still tugging a glove on and pulling the other up, clenched between my teeth, as we stormed out the front door into those dune-like drifts of white desert. The first thing I did was fall backwards, as if I'd been shot, my arms spread out, to land in the cushion of snow beneath me. I flailed my arms and legs back and forth until I no longer felt any snow being pushed away from my body. Then I stood up and turned around to admire my work, as if this were a piece of art I'd been carefully making, a snow angel. "Baby," said Toby from somewhere nearby. I looked over my shoulder. He was rolling a boulder of snow on the ground. It grew slowly in size as he pushed it through the front yard until he stopped and said, "That looks big enough," and I guessed that he was building a snowman. "Baby," I thought. But I knew better than to say it. If I did, it would only lead to him chasing me until I fell down, and then a swift and thorough torturing would take place, consisting of me pushing and screaming for Toby to get off, while he stuffed snow down my collar and into the cuffs of my boots and pant legs. I went over to where he was making the snowman instead and asked if I could help. He nodded, and together we rolled around the midsection until Toby said it was ready, and then we lifted it up onto the base. "Get sticks from the woods for his arms," Toby said as he rolled the head. "I'll go down the lane to Grandma's and ask for some coal to do his face." "Okay," I said, and rushed around the side of the house toward the field and back, following my orders. The field behind our house has always been a place where I can see myself more clearly, the same way I can see the seasons there, as if the field were a frame, focusing my attention. In spring, it turns a riotous green, and in summer, the grass bends with the shape of the wind, showing a silvery backside. Daisies and buttercups grow amid the clover, bringing white butterflies to them on hot summer days. By the time autumn comes, though, the field's been harvested for hay several times already, making it look like a brown and barren wasteland. And in winter, when snow covers it, the field becomes a wide white desert bordered on two sides by woods whose trees have been stripped of leaves, whose branches reach toward the sky, as if imploring the gods to send them the sun again. I ran into that white desert, my boots sinking deeper and deeper the further in I went. When I reached the border of the woods at the back where our father had stacked piles of dead fallen branches earlier that autumn, I selected two that looked like arms with crooked fingers and dragged them behind me back up to the house. I was halfway across the field again, my head down, tired by the effort of tramping back through my tracks in the snow, my breath coming out in feathery plumes in front of me, when I felt the first snowball smack me on the side of my head. By the time I recovered from the shock to look toward where the snowball had come from, it was too late to avoid the second one hurtling through the air toward me at that very moment. Smack. I took the hit in my mouth. Tumbling backward, I fell on my behind, dropping the branches I'd been dragging. Then laughter, my brothers a little ways off. I sat up and looked around but couldn't see them. Then the tip of Toby's stocking cap appeared over a ledge of snow before he rose up out of the snow itself, it seemed, and hurled another snowball at me. Trenches, I thought. Those bastards. Toby's snowball landed beside me, splattering, and in that same instant I rolled over a small drift and pressed myself in, digging deep with my arms and legs like I'd done to make my snow angel. Another snowball crashed beside me as I burrowed in, and when I finally had a small wall between us, I turned to peer over the ledge of my trench to see Ren packing a snowball, tighter and tighter. "You're dead, Aiden," he shouted, then threw the snowball like he did his best fastball. I watched the ball hurl toward me and ducked at the last minute, thinking my drift would be enough protection. But Ren had packed the ball so tight it burst through the top. Snow crumbled over my head and shoulders, and in the next moment, as I wiped the melt from my face, I heard an explosion that rocked the ground beneath me. I turned to look over the rim of what was left of my trench wall. I shivered, but not from the cold. Fog had rolled over the field, a cold rain drizzled, and night had come down on us already, even though my brothers and I had just run out into a bright winter morning an hour earlier. I looked at my gloved hands, where seconds before I'd been packing a snowball for my retaliation, and found them covered in mud. Another explosion rang in my ears, nearby this time, so near my teeth rattled, top against bottom. Then gunfire chattered, and men were shouting and screaming at one another and at God. "Hold the line," someone ordered. He'd made it to where he'd been going, I knew then. There he was, my great-grandfather, crouching, his back against a column of sandbags, a rifle cradled in one arm, the helmet on his head reminding me more of a flying saucer than any sort of protection from artillery. He was covered in dirt, covered in mud, his breath coming heavy, eyes wide with shock and fear. "Look out," someone shouted. I looked around to see who had spoken, and though there were other men in mud-covered uniforms, I couldn't tell who was in charge. Hunched over, they ran through a series of shallow trenches, carrying packs on their shoulders, like ants shuttling through hillside tunnels. "Here comes the gas again," someone said. "Cover up, lads, and be quick about it." He'd made it to England to join the fighting, my great-grandfather, but when he arrived, he was no longer British. He was an American, and Americans hadn't yet joined the war. They were waiting, those lousy colonials. The Canadians, though, had remembered where they'd come from. They'd sent their boys over. A body was a body, and they would make some sort of use of my great-grandfather, though. So he was placed in the ranks of the Canadians who'd come to fight against the Germans, a group of former Highlanders from Calgary. They were an excitable group. But the British officer who'd told them their positions and what was expected of them couldn't stop from sneering just a little. Like civilians back home, they lacked not only training, but any idea of what was going to happen to them. What kind of help would they be in the trenches? "Hold the line," someone had shouted, and they did. After the French colonials and Algerians evacuated 4 miles of the salient, that jut of wetland on the front line where, positioned slightly above them, the Germans had released a yellow-green cloud out of their trenches earlier that evening. I use these words now, this language, because it is the language used in a book I read for a class in world history once upon a time. The words in that book showed me what I'd already seen, and what it showed me was this. My great-grandfather watched the gas come. Tucked into the trenches with the Canadians, he saw the green cloud roll toward the French in the trench to the right of him. Slowly it crept, slowly it slithered down that ruined slope of earth until it found their trench and slid inside, and then inside them. It burned their eyes and lungs, choking the soldiers in its mist. Within 10 minutes, the French who hadn't died of suffocation were climbing out of the trench and running away, leaving miles of their line open for the Germans to move in. "Piss on your handkerchief and wrap around your nose and mouth." This was the order that came down the line. This was the thing that would protect them all from the green gas that had killed the Frenchmen whose bodies they'd find in the first line of trenches later. My great-grandfather pulled his cock out with the rest of them, waiting for a stream of piss, while all around him the sky cracked open and volcanic light from another world poured into his. Shells blasted the earth. Trees fell. The ground buckled. Another wall of the shoddy trenches into which they'd been inserted crumbled around them. Then, while a machine gun turned the ground to tatters in front of him, his piss finally came. He directed it to the cloth he held, spattering his hand in the process. When he finished, he put himself away and tied the kerchief around his nose and mouth. His eyes burned. There was no protecting them. The gas lingered in the ditches and dugouts, seeking wet, warm flesh. Despite the piss-saturated cloth over his mouth and nose, trails of the gas found its way into his lungs, but it couldn't strangle him like it did its other victims. Night grows. It grows deep and dark, and finally the shelling stops. The Huns have taken Kitchener's woods, the Canadians and my great-grandfather are told, only 600 yards in front of them. They mustn't allow the Germans even an inch. They're to take the woods back immediately. So, under the cover of night, they line up. Hundreds of Canadians and at least one former British turned American, all wondering what they'd been thinking to leave their families a world away and come here, all wondering how a place like this could exist. No man's land, their officer calls it. Hell, says my great-grandfather, under his breath. They take a path to the woods, all in strict formation, but halfway there they run into a hedge of brambles full of barbed wire. Break through, their commanding officer orders. They do. They break into the hedge and push the barbed wire away with the butts of their rifles. But what noise, what clamor and clatter as they force their way towards Kitchener's woods. They will surprise no one. Inside the woods, the Germans are waiting. They've heard them coming and are ready. When they see the Canadian shadows running toward them, they open fire and bodies begin to fall in the mud and muck surrounding them. The man running beside my great-grandfather is one of the first to drop. First a guttural sound, then a noise like choking. My great-grandfather doesn't stop to see if he can help. He keeps running. He tells himself he has to. If he can run long enough, fast enough, he might run all the way around the world and find himself back on his property, on the farm he bought in Ohio, where his wife and children are growing older as they wait for his return. He passes into the dark, shadowy trees of Kitchener's woods and cannot help but think of the child who wandered off the path in a fairy tale. There was a wolf in the woods waiting to eat her, and there are wolves in the woods waiting to eat him now. Their shadows move between tree trunks. Their gunfire breaks sparks against the dark. Then a bullet finds his stomach, and suddenly breathless, he stops running and puts his hand on the wound, wondering what he should do with this new opening in his body. It's a strange sensation, no pain or nothing he can immediately understand as pain. While he stands there not comprehending what's happened, another bullet cuts through his uniform, into his flesh, lodging between his shoulder and collarbone. It nestles in his body, hot, a hard thing. He looks up, not knowing where to go, what to do now. The other men are running ahead of him, gunfire blasting. He should follow them. He should go toward the battle. He takes a step in that direction, but before his second step falls, he sees a silvery white light floating in the distance. He looks hard, squinting to see the flick of a white tail at the edge of the woods. You again. The stag turns to look at him over its large round shoulder, its rack glinting with the same silver light that surrounds its body. It snorts, steam erupting from dark hollows, lifts its right hoof, then jumps away from him, further into the woods, the chase begun. He follows the stag instead of the men now. It's a chase he finally understands. He's seen it before, just barely, just once, and gave chase then only to find empty air when he rounded the trees it had passed by to escape him. I won't lose you this time, he thinks. Gunfire chatters around him, but he holds his stomach and stumbles forward, keeping the stag's tail in his line of vision, watching its legs kick as it runs further from him. He chases for what feels like an eternity, but it is perhaps only the next 5 minutes of what remains of his life. When he stops to catch his breath, the stag stops. It waits for him. Quit playing with me, he thinks. And when he gathers enough strength to give chase again, the muscles in the stag's haunches flex for an instant before it leaps ahead of him again, looking back to make sure the man with the bullet in his stomach and the hole in his chest is still following. In a small grove of Kitchener's woods, or perhaps it is in some other woods that is, in truth, any and all woods that have ever existed, the stag waits for my great-grandfather to catch up. When he arrives, his breath coming in ragged convulsions, his blood darkening his clothes where the bullets have entered, the stag doesn't run any further. My great-grandfather blinks as he meets the stag's stare. Its eyes seem to grow as he looks into them, become larger, rounder, darker. Like tunnels, a person could walk into them. Like trenches, you could hide in them, and no one, nothing, not shells, not gas or grenades, would ever find you in there. My great-grandfather takes a step forward, but falls as he attempts a second. A shallow stream trickles along the floor of the woods, winking with reflected light from the moon and stars that peer down on this alongside me. Mirrors the glow of the stag's antlers as it lowers its head to the water, a cup of light blossoming in the night. My great-grandfather looks where the stag looks, sees the glinting stream before him as a man lost in the desert will see water all around him, the thing to go to, the thing that will quiet his convulsions and coughing, the thing that will quench his thirst. Drink, the stag tells my great-grandfather, and the tips of its antlers touch the surface of the water for a moment, turning it into a stream of white light. My great-grandfather doesn't know if he's heard the stag or if the stag has somehow put its voice inside him, but he does as he's told. He crawls the few feet it takes to reach the bank of the creek, and there he leans over to find his own reflection staring back at him. He draws closer to it, closer, and when his face meets the face in the water, the two merging into one another, he opens his mouth and fills himself with himself. He will die there, 20 minutes later, his body half in and half out of the creek, the film reel of his life rattling over and over as the wheel it spins on comes to a halt, and the screen is full of silence and white light. When the stag leaves, dawn will be on the horizon, and when the sun rises red and bloody, the Canadians will have taken back these woods, a woods full of the bodies of men like my great-grandfather. As I walk among them, a young man with his helmet askew looks at me and says, "Are you my guardian angel?" But I don't say anything. He kneels to pray then, to what is only me, another illusion in his desert, a boy from a future he'll never see. I go back then, back and back and back and back and back and back and back into the snowy field where Ren kneels beside me, shaking my shoulders over and over as he calls my name. "Aiden, what's the matter with you? Aiden, answer me." Then Toby arrives with my mother, who's come out of the house with only her slacks and sweater and boots on. She kneels down too, cups my cheeks in her hands. "He's going to be all right. He's coming back. Go put some water on to boil, Toby," she says, as if she's going to deliver a child like a midwife. She lifts me up with the help of Ren, each one holding me with their shoulders under my arms, their arms laced around my back. And in that way, we stumble back to the house through the snow, where she'll make me chicken soup with oyster crackers floating in the broth and force me to stay in bed for the rest of the evening. "What did you see?" she asks later, after my father has come home from work and been in to see me, after my brothers have both visited, Ren agitated but pursing his lips and looking anywhere else around my room but at me, as if he feels guilty, as if the snowball fight had been the cause of the whole incident. Toby, angry as usual, whispering through gritted teeth, "You don't have no visions, Aiden. Stop fucking around," before he leaves. After she's put on her pajamas and is ready to put herself to bed, my mother says, "What did you see out there, Aiden?" At the time, I could only shake my head. I didn't know exactly what I'd seen, only that it was war, only that it was death, only that it was a certain kind of darkness, an entity, a black storm-filled cloud rolling forward across the expanse of a wide blue sky, devouring everything in its path. Years later, in that history class, where I'll see all of this in a textbook, I'll recognize this place and the people, what they were doing, where they were going, and in a lecture hall full of strangers, I will learn the names for the things I witnessed that day. But right then, when my mother asks, "What did you see out there?" I can only shake my head. Before she leaves, I call her back and she turns to hear what I have to tell her. "Hell," I tell her. "I think I saw hell." Thank you.